right, it's 5 o'clock, so I think we're gonna go ahead and get started. I really appreciate anyone who will go to a 400 level session at 5 o'clock, right before the Ask the Expert. So, we have our lovely assistant, Beza. No, I'm kidding. Thanks, Beza. So developer track, we're up here in the penthouse. Love it. So this is a deep dive into SharePoint 2013 CSOM APIs. My name is Steve Walker. I'm a senior program manager for Microsoft. I'm on the Office 365 customer advisory team, previously on the SharePoint customer advisory team, but I focused on application development extensibility scenarios. I have twisted and bent SharePoint in ways that maybe I shouldn't have. And then here is Travis Falls. He's a senior consultant from Microsoft Services, and we will be tag teaming this presentation today. Without any further ado, I will just jump right into it. So I think if you guys have been going to the DevTrack sessions, you've probably seen this slide. We really are looking at Office 365 as a platform now. I think some of the preview features that you've seen from the dev teams really do show that. And so we want to have a rich set of Office 365 APIs, you know, be able to get to your documents, your mail, your calendars, people in groups, and flexible tools, and to be able to render it on the devices that your users are using. So that's the vision, you know, and how to, all of us here are probably SharePointers. Hopefully over the next, you know, couple of years, we all start developing for Office, so to speak. So we really are at a phase where we have an opportunity to have a developer renaissance. Right now, the way that folks develop on SharePoint and have traditionally, myself included, I have built some really, really big systems, both when I was in consulting services and prior at partners. And then in my role in the product team, I deal with some of those big customers who have built really, really, really big systems, and maybe they shouldn't have done certain things certain ways. So I've got a lot of experience in you know, the pitfalls that can accrue from our traditional development scenarios. Right now, the way that you develop SharePoint, your app runs in the SharePoint process. It is inside the ASP.NET process. We are very tightly coupled. SharePoint and your customization, it's like running a three-legged race. Your legs are tied together, and we're going at the same speed. And anyone trips, that brings us both down. That's a very untenable position to be in when you're especially looking at a cloud type situation. So it also requires deep understanding of the SharePoint UI and the server object model. We have a shared process space. It's efficient, but it's risky. All right. We have these protocols that were introduced in SharePoint 2010 that we have improved vastly upon in SharePoint 2013. We're going to talk a lot about them today. These protocols allow you to drive a wedge in your monolithic development scenarios. So you can decouple the SharePoint idioms and logic from your application idioms and logic in a nice way that allows you to upgrade either side of it and be a little more comfortable that's gonna be okay without a huge amount of testing. The vision now is that we're going to move to a more traditional development model, where the UI aggregates at the client and not on the server and gets spit down to the client. We believe that this is necessary not just in the SharePoint space, but also you know, across the Office suite and some of the things that you've seen us innovate on, even on the Exchange side, with our mail apps and those kinds of things. You can see the potential and the benefit moving forward. Since this is a 400-level session, I thought I'd throw the scariest thing I could throw out here, which would be an OSI stack diagram. Really, what this really shows is that we are built upon industry standards, you know, IP, TCP, HTTP, JSON, ADAM and XML. And then on top of that, we've got some Microsoft open specifications. And so these are actually publicly documented specs, and we adhere to them very well. Can rely on them. We will communicate to you that, you know, when we're changing the surface area of these things. So because they're publicly documented, they are a lot more reliable. Not everything that we do inside the server object model is publicly documented, and I have seen lots of people do things like reflect assemblies and invoke private methods, and while it may work for you today, it may not work for you tomorrow. You can depend on these. And then above that stack, we've got our APIs, and then we've got the consumers of said APIs. These can be browsers, these can be Windows clients, ASP.NET apps, workflows, event receivers. If you've seen how our new workflow model is, it really doesn't live on the SharePoint box anymore. It uses these APIs to talk back to SharePoint. And I am going to go kind of fast because it is 5 o'clock and we've got to ask the experts later, so bear with me. I figure if it's 400, you guys can keep up. So in SharePoint 2013, the remote API, we have this really, really cool new thing. It's called underscore API. So if you've been to like Rob Howard's power, developer power hour, he showed a little bit about it. It is underscore VTI bin slash client.svc. Bonus points, anybody in the room know what VTI stands for? Oh, I got one in the back. Yes, Vermeer Technologies. That man gets a shirt. Come up afterwards, I'll give you one. That is a company that Microsoft acquired that wrote a product called FrontPage, and how many years has it been? And we still can't get rid of VTI out of everything, right? But really what this was is we created an abstraction on the server so that developers would not have to look in many, many, many different locations for these various services. So it has opened up a lot of possibilities, not just for CSOM, but also the other, JSOM, REST, those types of things. And then sitting on top of that, we've got client code, or consuming that, we have client code, and there's lots of different client code assemblies. There's the base SharePoint ones, there's sharing, there's eDiscovery, social, workflow. I won't go into the details of all of them. But underscore API is all you need in 2013. So in 2010, we had CSOM. So most folks who were doing 2010 development were probably aware that we had a client-side object model in 2010. And in 2010, we did have REST, but it was at VTI bin slash listdata.svc, and it was really just for manipulating list data. So in 2013, we consolidated them into underscore API. And we also massively expanded the restfulness of SharePoint. Everybody likes to have their SharePoint rested. And then not only lists in this release, but we have all kinds of objects that you can get to through the REST interface, sites, webs, collections of sites, webs, lists, collections. It's pretty powerful. And then we've introduced a lot of more advanced query capabilities. So a little kitty fun fact here, because I am on the engineering team and I like to geek out with code. How does API underscore API map to VTI bin, client.svc? So you can see here, actually it is an illustration, it's not the actual code. I didn't bring our source code here. It's a little nastier when you go look at it, the source code. But this gets the high level concept across. You can see that we're really just mapping VTI bin, client.svc to the underscore API so that it's available at that location. And then you think, well, how does client SVC handle both REST and CSOM through that one particular endpoint? Again, this is an illustration, but it gets the point across. You can see that we have an iClient request service, and we have process query. If the method is post and the URI template is process query, then CSOM is going to handle it. Case else, it's going to go down process REST query. That's how we do that through that single interface. Again, this is server code. I do not recommend you go write your own iClient request service. That's probably a customization that's not for the faint of heart and would definitely not be one we would want to support. So let's talk a little bit about CSOM, or MS-CSOM, as the public specification is called. So what's nice about CSOM? It is structured, it's strongly typed, it's pragmatic, it's abstracted. Those all sound like really cool, good things, right? It's hierarchical and it's stateful, which is kind of important and we're going to talk about a little bit more later, as opposed to REST, which is a stateless, more HTTP request response pattern, and you don't maintain that state across. It's also familiar for folks who are used to the object model. So if you've been writing object model code for a number of years, like a lot of us have, then you'll find a lot of familiarity in the way we name the objects and the collections and things of that nature. So very familiar. It's efficient and concise in operation and syntax. So you can use link, and I don't mean the SP metal kind of link. I mean the link for objects. You can use CAML for processing queries. I know people kind of shudder when you talk about doing CAML sometimes, but it actually is pretty efficient when you're doing CSOM and you want to do queries. I promise you don't have to worry about what a content type ref is. And then you can also do batching, which is really, really important when you're looking to do things across the wire. Sometimes you don't want to have a really chatty interface, and CSOM can really help you there. It's also much easier to do test-driven development against as opposed to REST. I won't go into the particulars. There's probably at least one person in this room who does test-driven development. I'm not in that camp. I think Travis here is. Highly documented, so got a lot of documentation out there on MSDN. There's IntelliSense, so kind of keeps the guardrails for you. And there's an object browser. So I want to talk a little bit about the CSOM foundational objects. And the approach we're taking with this, just so that you guys know, is we're being very slide heavy at first, so I can set up a lot of context, and then he's going to show off a whole bunch of code. So folks who want to see code, we got code for you. Don't wait. So one of the core foundational objects of CSOM is called the client context. This is the root of the local cache, and this object actually brokers communication to the server, and it's disposable. We have a client object. So this is a cache of transient data. It is translated to XML on request. It's deserialized from JSON on response. Some examples of that are site, keyword, query, search, executor. So we do the plumbing for you. We do the serialization and the deserialization of the objects from your code up to the server in a nice way. So no learning interesting RESTful type URLs to get what you want. It is a securable object, so it derives, there's a securable object. It derives from client object, and that's where we add our authorization semantics. There's a client value object. It's similar to a client object, but it's for simple data types. So the client object, there's a lot of overhead to the client object because it has to deal with these complex data types and marshaling those things back and forth. So it's very similar to the client object, but it's for very simple data types. There's also a client object collection. This is a collection. It's queryable. It's enumerable. So we have things like list collections, list item collections, field collections. And then we have client results. It's a result of a method invocation. So I want to get feed for circexecutor.execute query. I'm really not going to sit up here and read code to you guys all day. I promise. So let's talk a little bit about the semantics of CSOM. So one of the core things that you need to do is you have to have a context. That context is what sets up your connection and your authentication to the server. So that's always one of the first things that you need to do, or actually the first thing that you need to do, is and we've got some helper classes there. You know, we've got SP client context get current if you're logged into say SharePoint already. The next thing you need to do is you actually need to build a request. So you context.load, load query, and then I say I want to do a new search executor off of the context, and then I have to say context.load. I see people often miss that step, so make sure you're loading. And then you want to execute the query, and there's two ways to execute the query. There's the synchronous, and then there's the asynchronous. Asynchronous programming is a little bit more, difficult to get your brain around, but once you do, it's definitely your friend. You can create a much more responsive user interface with asynchronous patterns there. And I think actually on the Windows phone, we don't even let you do synchronous.
That is correct. We stop you at the compile time telling you you're going to block a UI thread.
Yep. So When you execute the query, basically what the engine, the client.svc, does is it takes that XML representation of the request that you've batched up, and it takes your context, and it translates that into server-side object model code, and it executes that against the server. You don't have to do that. Very helpful. I don't want to write that code. And then you process the results. So after you've executed the query, you're going to get the results back, and then you can take action upon those results. So, you know, I've got a web back and I want to get the title of that web. At that point, I can do that. Before I execute that query, those objects are actually not hydrated. Those are not valid objects. And then you can wash, rinse, and repeat. So often you will, make a CSOM query to the server, you will get some data back, and then maybe you want to take action. The user clicks on one of those items that you've displayed, and you're going to, you know, take the same trip again. So when you're creating a context, this is the top-level object of an interlinked hierarchy, but it is the one that is always required. You can't do anything without a context. Serialize, transmit, receive, and deserialize. That's all handled there. It establishes the authentication approach. So we give an example of acquiring context there. Travis is going to give a lot better examples when he's actually showing you code. There are token helper classes. I'm not going to go too deep into that, but there's low trust and high trust versions of that. So low trust being you're using ACS, you're developing against our cloud. High trust being I'm using server-to-server auth, maybe on-prem. And then there's also ways to do things like FBA and basic Windows authentication as well. So I'm building a request. I need to create and initialize my client objects. I load those objects or actions into the context. The context is the thing that wraps everything. I do a load. That is an in-place load. So that gives me data in the object itself. So some objects are implicitly loaded by the constructor. We take care of that for you if we need to do that. So sometimes there's dependencies between these objects, and maybe we need to go get some data in order to hydrate that so that we could set up the next step. Load query, so that's a queryable load, so that returns data in another result array. No effect on the object state, so the objects that you started with are still the objects that you had, so there's a minor difference there. And you can do link to objects, which is actually pretty cool. This is not linked to SharePoint, so if anybody says, can I use SPMetal here, I'm going to say nope. So query syntax, only load query. So say I'm going to do from x and y, where x equals cow, you know, x.cow equals moo, select x. I can also do method syntax. On either one, I can do method syntax. So I can say, you know, y.where x equal to greater than x.cow equal moo. So that's very powerful. You know, you don't have to write a lot of code, a lot of digits, and you can manipulate and query these objects very easily. I do recommend that you use CAML to query lists instead of link, and we will talk a little bit more about why you would want to do that here in a minute. So when I execute a query, the first and only time the request is exchanged with the server, that context object orchestrates that round trip. So if you look at that diagram that I drew before, we were batching up all of the things that we wanted to do to the server. And then, again, there are synchronous or asynchronous options, and I suggest that you look at those asynchronous options. You basically just have to provide it a callback method in your JavaScript and be able to get to that. So when you process the results, you're moving data in and out of in-memory objects. There's not a lot of significant performance concerns. If you get to this step, and you get the not initialized exception, which is the CSOM version of hResult, in my opinion, you're missing a load directive. So I see that mistake a lot as well. So we pointed that out earlier, but I just want to reinforce that again. And then you can do link to objects here as well. So still, again, pretty powerful way to query through these things. So here's an example of actually using CSOM with a CAML query. So first, we're setting up our client context. the context equals new context, and I pass it the URL to my site, because I've got to tell it where I'm trying to execute this request. I tell it I want a list. You notice these have nice colored colors, strongly typed, IntelliSense. I love that. And then I tell it my OList is the context.web.lists.getbytitle announcements. So what that means is I'm going to get the announcements list out of that web. And then I'm going to set up a camel query. Why would I want to do that? Because I probably don't want to bring back everything in the list. That might be a fairly expensive operation to pull back two or three things. You don't want to pull back 5,000. Your network guys might scream. Your users are going to wonder why this thing has got high latency and they have to wait forever when all they wanted was two announcements out of the list from last week. And so then I get a list item collection, set up a list item collection, and I call olist.getItems, camel query. I say context.load, oItems. At this point, I still don't have any data. None of this has gone to the server yet at this point, right? I'm setting up the things that I want to do on the server before I send that request. So the magic happens when I say context.executeQuery. And then I can iterate through. So here I'm going to go through each list item, and I'm just going to, you know, console write line, I'm going to write out the title, the body of the list item that are returned based on the query. So I don't know how many Taco Cat announcements there are, but whatever there are, I'll write those items out. So CSOM search, so we actually have search CSOM using keyword queries. Here's an example here. And basically, I'll go a little bit faster because I think we're starting to see a pattern here, which is set up my context to my site. Now I'm setting up a keyword query, and I'm giving it my context. And my query text, I'm saying I want anything with a content type ID that starts with that 0x0104. And then I give it my select properties. So it's not going to return me back everything from the search index. By default, that could be quite a lot of data, so it allows me to select which items from the search I actually want to return. So I'm saying that I want to see the title, and I want to see the content type ID. And then I have a search executor, so I've set up my keyword query. I have an executor. I have a new search executor with the context, and then I'm setting up a collection of client results, and then I'm actually going to execute my query there. And then I can iterate through them. Now, this is actually pretty cool, so if you want to interact with search. But I will say that the search query web service is deprecated. We have new functionality in 2013 using the, what is it, FQL, the functional query language, that I would recommend if if you're just starting your development, use that instead so that you don't accrue a bunch of technical debt. Because at some point, this is going to go away. We have CSOM for social, so if you want to get in there and you want to look at things like users, feeds, likes, follows, we have CSOM for you. You don't have to write server-side code to go get access to that stuff. And you'll notice we've got a couple using statements there. I'm going to talk about the assemblies here in a little bit, but there's some base assemblies that you have to reference, and then there's also some specific assemblies based upon what kinds of data that you're looking for. So here we're setting up a social feed manager. I'm going to stop skipping the context piece. And then I have social feed options. I'm giving it a sort order. I'm telling it that my social feed sort order is by created time, so I want to see these things by the time they were created. I'm setting up a client result. I get my feed result, and I say feed manager get feed, so fm.getfeed. I pass it the news feed, and I give it my options. And then I execute the query. And then I get the feed result.value. And then I can iterate through that. And I can look at things like the social actor, the person who actually took the social action. I can look at the social post. I can look at the root post if it was a reply, because you got to think a social has a hierarchy to those messages. And then I'm going to write that out. So being able to get access to your social. This is for SharePoint social. If you're using Yammer, no CSOM for you. We have CSOM for taxonomy, so both terms and navigation. I got a link to the spec there. I won't dive into that. So you'll notice that we have a Microsoft SharePoint client taxonomy reference that we've got. I can set up a taxonomy session. I can say get taxonomy session with my context. I can set up a term store. I want to get the default site collection term store. Okay. You notice that each one of these libraries has a little bit different implementation pattern, different objects that you're interacting with, but they're all strongly typed, and we have great documentation on this stuff. So the term set collection, I want to say I want to get the term sets by name. I want to get the colors and 1033. Apparently, this is not a multilingual sample. This is English only. And then context.load. And then execute my query. Sorry, my throat's dry. And then I get an array back of the term, the colors, and then I can iterate through those and write those out in my console. So if you're doing things like navigation, if you're doing things like metadata, client-side, it's very useful in a lot of different situations. So we talk here a little bit about optimizing your requests with link. You can see that the one on the left that I have here has a larger response, and I'm filtering it at the client. So back to my comment earlier about querying with CAML, this is the approaches you can take with link. I'm actually grabbing, for this, I'm grabbing a collection of the lists on the web, and I am loading that, I'm executing the query, so that's going to give me back the entire lists collection. That might be great if you have a, you know, just a small number of lists. But I have personally seen folks go create hundreds of lists and sites, so you can imagine that this query would get very expensive on the server, and it might work fine to start with, but then as people start using the site, it could slow down depending on how much data it's coming back. But it is a valid pattern. You just want to, you know, make sure you're making a conscious decision to get everything when you do that. And then the alternative here is I can actually use link and I can filter it on the server. So similar to the way I showed you before in the list query where I was using CAML, here I can use link, and I'm telling it I'm setting up a query, and from list in my context.web.lists, where list.hidden equals true, select list, and then I'm doing my load query, and I'm doing my execute query. So what this is going to do is just give me back the collection of hidden lists. So if I have lists with certain types or lists with certain properties that are set on them, I can retrieve back a subset of those lists through link. So I want to talk a little bit about the matching request model. I have spoken to it, but a visual is always nice. So on the client, you've got custom client-side code. So this is the code you write. And things like find lists, execute list queries, get results, right? I have request batching in the client object model. So my find lists, execute list queries, and get results are all batched up into that object. This is still all happening on the client. I've had no interaction with the server, even though there's been three operations. And then after that, it's going to request those batches to the server. The server is going to execute those against the server object model. And then those results are going to come back through the client object model. And then you can do what you want in your code to use those results. So, if you think about that in a RESTful pattern, that could be very chatty, right? Every one of those would be a request up to the server, and depending on your latency, depending on a lot of other factors, that may or may not be accepted. So CSOM can help there. Because this is a 400-level session, I like to throw things like fiddler traces in there. No. So this is just to kind of show you what this looks like. So the request that you are sending to the server contains actions, which are behavior, and they contain object paths, which are data, and I've circled those there. You can see that this is actually in an XML format. The actions link to object paths, all right? So every one of those actions has a link to an object path. And then objects form hierarchies with parent IDs. And so you can look at the method there has an ID of 7, and then the method below it has a parent ID of 7. It's an ID of 10. So that's how I can build a hierarchy of items that are going to get sent up to the server, because a lot of times there's dependencies on the calls that we're going to batch up to the server, and this is how we manage that in the request. So some typical actions, object path, instantiate an object, query, gets scalar values for objects and types, And then I can set static properties that obviously assigns an object property. And then the typical object paths that we have, static properties, static object property. You've got a property, property of another object, and then a method, which is the result of a method call. And then I want to show you what the response looks like. And you'll notice that, so typically, you noticed on the slide before that this was in an XML format. There's a little additional overhead to that, but we do gain some benefit. But these typically, the requests that you're sending to the server are not terribly large, but the responses that you get back from the server are sometimes terribly large, and so we want to be very efficient at how we handle that. And so we use JSON on the response that's coming back. So we save, I think, about 30% overhead versus giving you an XML response. And don't worry, we take care of translating that JSON for you. So the object IDs requests align with the request IDs. The protocol defines a standard envelope, so metadata. So an example is object type. You know, gotta love the underscores, but. Other properties carry data. So you look down there and you can see these actually have the data for what's being returned. So I said before, you noticed in those examples, we were referencing a bunch of client assemblies. So these are assemblies that we ship. There's a redistributable that you can use to actually reference these assemblies. So you always have to reference the client runtime, the client.dll. But then depending on what specific functionality, what CSOM functionality that you require, you may need to reference other ones. So if I'm trying to interact with publishing or search or taxonomy, user profiles, each one of them have their own DLL. And so if you want the IntelliSense, if you want the, you know, the goodness that comes with that, or you want it to work at all, you must actually reference the appropriate assemblies. So I see that mistake a lot. And I have a white screen. All right, and with that, let's look at some code. So I'm going to turn it over to Travis, and I'm going to let Travis actually walk us through a little bit of CSOM code and what this looks like in action. Look at there.
Okay. So I'm going to start just by introducing myself again. I'm Travis Falls. I'm a senior consultant with MCS. I want to ask everyone a question. How many here have kind of gone all in on CSOM and client-side development? All right, we got a good number.
We like that.
About a third of the room. Okay, how many people have kind of dabbled with it but decided, hey, it's not really for me right now, it doesn't meet my needs? Well, only a couple, that's good. I'd like to see that. All right, the first example I'm gonna be doing here, it's a standalone application. It's a client, it's a console client application that's going to go out, it's gonna enumerate sites. So the important thing that I wanna make sure I highlight is this application does not run, like we were talking, within SharePoint, it's running next to SharePoint. And actually, my SharePoint environment is a multi-tenant hosted environment up in O365. So we're actually going to connect right out to that, and we're going to pull some data back. The way I'm going to demo this for you, I'm going to go through the actual program and how it works. I'm going to run it, and then we're going to dig a little deeper into the codes after you see the results. I think it'll make a little more sense. Okay, so we're looking right here at the main method, and I'm building out some objects. We've got a custom object, which we're going to walk through, which is I have an instance called CSOM service. And then we have the client credentials that we're building up. I'm sure you're noticing here I'm passing in my password and the URL and all that. I know passing passwords in isn't always a great idea. I just want to illustrate here that you can do that, and there are other options such as OAuth and things like that. But that isn't the point of this demo, so I just wanted to kind of call that out before I got a bunch of questions on how the auth works.
Before somebody said you have an insecure demo?
Yes, exactly. All right, so we're building up this credentials object. And we're hard coding a couple things in. We're calling a method called getPassword. That's just going to read right out of the console app what I'm typing in. It's not going to show you guys my password, but there's no reason to go into that plumbing piece of it. At that point, we're going to write out after we get the password just a line, and then if you see here, we're calling that custom object that we built, CSOM service, and we're calling the site search. Site search is returning a list of sites. Now that list of sites might be kind of heavy, and as Steve showed you in the slides, you might want to refine that a little bit. So right here, we're going to do, below that, we're going to do a link query to refine it. And it's only going to pull back sites that contain the name USA Rugby. I'm sure you guys can guess what my favorite sport is. So no mystery there. After we pull that back and filter it, we're going to loop through, and I'm going to output the title, the URL, the description, and the web template used. So you'll notice when I run this, remember that I'm filtering for USA Rugby, so I shouldn't get any sites back that have anything else but some subset of that name in the title. All right, we're going to go ahead and F5 this. Let's hope the demo gods are with me today.
So right now, at least you're not storing that password.
No, I am not. All right, so we've run. So what we did right there was we took those passwords, we bashed all that up, we reached out to some other code that I'm going to walk through after we look at the results here, and we built this up the queries, we pulled it back, we filtered it, and as I was saying before, if you look at the path on each one of these returns, they maintain some piece of USA Rugby, so we successfully filtered that. Let's see how we did that. The first piece I'm going to walk through is is some plumbing. It's how we did our authentication piece. So I'm going to bring up this authentication CS file. There's some method calls in here that are pertinent to the CSOM piece, and then there's some pieces that are just kind of model. They're, you know, I'm storing some data. So I'm going to skip over the model stuff where I'm storing my URL and stuff like that. And we're going to get down to where we actually build out that client context. So Steven showed, you know, it's very important that we get that client context first. That's how we get our handle into the server from the client side. We need that before we do anything else. So here we're calling out to build out this client context. I'm going to jump right down to it so you can see what we do. We're checking to see if the credentials are null, and then we're grabbing that password from the secure string, we're building it up, and then we're returning the credentials. So now those credentials are stored in a variable above this, so we can access a global variable. And then we're taking that and we're building out the actual client context, and we're assigning those credentials and we're returning it. So that's how we're building out that actual authentication piece that when I go back to the program, we're just assigning. So right up here, we're calling that credential authentication instance. There's a singleton there that was running. We're passing that into our object that we're about to look at as an authentication object. All right, so I've got this kind of queued up to where I thought it was pertinent. Oh, I selected the wrong object. Sorry about that. There we go. I want to show right here at the top, as Steve had in his slides, there's a couple using statements. If I didn't have these here, this wouldn't work. This is very, you know, important to know that we include these. This is how we're getting access to everything. So I needed access to the SharePoint.client and then the client.search.query.
And you'd have nice red squigglies if you didn't have those in there.
That is correct. Pretty obvious. So if we remember, I called right here, we called the CSOM service dot site search. So let's look at that method. I'm gonna go right to definition on that to speed us up. This is just we're just overloading a call that's very similar. We're just passing in a string. We're passing in an empty string here because we're not filtering at that point. So we're gonna go right down to this guy. All right. So here we're passing an empty string. We're building out that list that we wanna return. We're using the context that we built from that authentication that we returned, and we're building out the keyword query. We're passing in, when we create that instance of that object, the CTX. The thing I want to highlight here, you guys haven't seen me call load, you haven't seen me call execute query. So right now I'm just building out a list of instructions. We're still on the client, nothing's really occurred. So as we continue to build out that list of instructions, we go through and I've got some logic here that basically states we don't want to return more than 500 items at a time. We want to batch this up. As Steve was saying, you know, batching is important. Whether we're chatty or we're chunky, that's the decision you have to make based on your architecture, but you have the option of controlling that. So we call process query here, and that's kind of what does the work. So let's jump right down and look at process query. We pass a lot of different things in. I'm not going to list them all for you because we're using them in the code, and this code will be made available after the session. But I just want to kind of illustrate here, you know, we're taking that keyword query and we're packing it full of all the information it needs. And again, we haven't reached up to that server yet, so we're just building that list of instructions on the client side. We're setting our query value, we're setting our row limit, which is 500, we're setting the start row so we know if we're starting at 0 or 5 or 1, depending on what part of the batch we're in. And then we're setting those selection properties, as Steve showed in the slides, and what we want to bring back, because we don't want to bring everything back. You know, this is... Though we're protecting ourselves by working in the client-side object model, it doesn't mean we get to just willy-nilly make rash decisions that can still impact our performance for our users. Though we might not impact SharePoint to the same extent by writing full trust code, you could still have a little bit of impact on those SQL servers. You can make them cry if you don't watch yourself. Sure. So we build all this up, we pass everything in, and we then create the search executor, as Steve showed in one of his examples in his slides, and we pass in that context. We then use the search executor, we call execute query, and we pass that keyword in. Below that, we take the actual context and we execute the query. Now we've actually done something. We've sent it up to the server, this huge list of instructions that we wanted done. and we're checking to see what our results are. And I'm building out a list of sites here where I'm taking just the items that I wanted. These are just the couple things you saw displayed. So we build all this back out, and we come back to our program, and that's how we get to here. So at that point, I'm just iterating over what I pulled back from the server. So that's pretty much how we can do this from a client, from a console app. And the key importance here is we've got the IntelliSense, we've got the compilability of the code, we've got the red squigglies when we want them. So it's very familiar for a developer that's used to working in a C-sharp model, but we're not on the server until we need to be on the server. So it allows us to scale and run next to SharePoint.
So I noticed something interesting there. You were using search to retrieve a list of sites. Why would you use that method versus other methods?
You can definitely use the tenant admin to get at that stuff, but you don't get your personal sites that way. So you really want to, you know, you want to dig into these to see what's coming back, what the limitations are. So by using the search method, I was able to bring back those personal sites. You saw my site come back when I ran that code. So let's go ahead and
flip over
the slides. A couple slides, guys, I promise.
A couple more slides and we'll get back into some code, because everybody loves to see code at 5:30 in the afternoon, right? I'm seeing a few gray faces, but a few smiley faces too. So similar to CSOM, we have a JavaScript object model as well. So here's a table of some of the differences between C# and JavaScript. So on the C# side, you get that nice familiar using Microsoft.SharePoint.client. I say familiar if you're a C# developer. On the JavaScript side, you get, you know, execute or delay until script loaded, init func sp.js. You actually, after you've written a few of these things, it starts to get a little more familiar. And we've got some great samples that we're going to walk through, and you could take the code home with you if you would like. So, and then on the C# side, you can see that the way we set up our client context, actually on the JavaScript side, it's about as easy. So that's nice. And then it really, from there on down, it really is like syntax differences, but we're accomplishing the same thing. Now, I will say here, there are some things that you can't do in JavaScript in the JSOM that you can do in the CSOM. The example I hear a lot of times people asking why is like send mail, right? Because maybe you don't want everybody in your business that can throw a piece of JavaScript in a web page to be able to spam mail within your organization. So those are conscious limitations that we make. C# code is typically a little more controlled, you know, if you're installing those things on your servers or you've got a little more governance over that. So I call it the anti-spammer. So some JavaScript namespaces that are definitely of interest to you. So you always need the sp.js. So this is very similar. You can see a pattern. So when we did this for the client-side object model, we had .NET assemblies that you needed to reference. Here you've got JavaScript name assemblies or JavaScript files that you need to reference. Same pattern that we have with the client assemblies. You've got sp.js, you've got a publishing one, a search one, a social one, a taxonomy one, user profiles. So you don't need to reference them all. You just need to reference the ones that you need to get your work done. And look at that. We're going to go back to demos. And we decided that Travis is just going to do two demos. We're calling these hybrid demos because these demos use both JSOM and CSOM together. So the first one, we've got a provider-hosted people picker demo. And then the second one, we've got a provider-hosted app to create subsites. So with that, I will turn it over to Travis.
All right. So we are going to show a lot more code. I hope you guys are excited about seeing more code like I am. I can look at code all day and pretty much do. So what I'm showing right here, this is just straight HTML. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I want to kind of illustrate that it is straight HTML from this perspective. I am going to show one piece in the code behind, but just to go down through, the important parts I wanted to highlight is we're using jQuery. You can see the reference right there. And we're using a file called app.js, which we're going to walk through, as well as the people picker control.js, which is pretty impressive, if you ask me. It's one of the more impressive pieces of JavaScript that I've gotten to read through and understand, and it's a great reference implementation. So in this file, you don't have to pay too much attention. I'm just kind of scrolling through to show you that there's no magic going on in the HTML. There's no, you know, crazy reach backs for other JavaScript or any other types of injections going on here. We just have a button at the bottom where we call, we've got an on-click event, and I'm going to show you the piece. So this is the piece that makes this the hybrid. So what we're looking at here, and I'm going to run this in a second, and I'm going to call out what I'm highlighting here. We're seeing a big piece of script getting built out. The function Chrome loaded, it's got the body.show out from the jQuery handle, and just building out some things where you see render SP Chrome and all that stuff. This is going to allow our provider-hosted app to look very similar to our branding that we have. So when I run this, I'm going to point out, you know, the URL is going to change, but the actual field of page shouldn't change much at all. So right here at the bottom here, we're doing a page.clientScript.registerScriptBlock. We're passing in the block that we had built up. If the page is not a postback, we're using some CSOM here to populate it with my name. It's the person that's logged into the actual application when I run it. So we're doing everything that we just talked about through the slides and through the other demo, where we're using the client context that we've gotten a handle to and from our using statement above. We're then loading it, passing in some information that we need, getting the current user for the web, and then we're executing that query. We're reaching up to that server to pull the data back, and then we're going to assign, when you notice when I run this, I'm going to be populated in the actual people picker right off the bat. So I'm going to go ahead and run it, and then we're going to finish walking through the JavaScript on how that makes it happen. Now, I will say my goal with these demos, this one very specifically, but them in general, is not to show you every line of code. I'm trying to call out, really kind of pinpoint exactly what the CSOM is doing in them. There's a lot that goes into these. So, but as we said, you guys are going to get a chance to take these home with you, so you can geek out as much as you want, pull the code all apart, and understand it at the deepest level you desire. So we're going to go ahead and F5 this guy. Cross your fingers for those demo gods again.
Wave the chicken bone.
I'm going to be asked to log into my tenant now. So logging in. I won't make you guys watch me fat finger this, hopefully. All right. So the URL right now is looking at usarugbysharepoint.com. So we're working on it, we're reaching out, we're doing things, and bang, we bring up, we got some nice branding here, this and that. Check that URL now, though. We're at localhost. So this is actually running locally, but it's a provider-hosted app. So that code that I was illustrating before in the JavaScript is actually injecting this branding, so it maintains that feel. Now, if I had some custom branding, it would actually bring that custom branding over with it, so it would maintain that feel for your site. So right here we have a selected user. You'll notice that I'm already in there. That's that CSOM code, the C# CSOM code that executed, that dropped me in there. Because this is my dev tenant, I've got one user. So I'm just going to delete myself out and show you guys how this works when we type in. So I'm going to type in T, nothing's really happening. It's just IE showing me that I've typed some other letters before. R, it's searching now. And there I am. I'm going to go ahead and select myself. It's going to drop me right in there. So this is a great example of how you can use CSOM just to do a people picker, which in the old days, people picker was kind of a tough thing to work with sometimes. You get yourself in trouble, really spend a lot of time, and it becomes an expensive endeavor. This is a great reference example on how you can do this either, you know, on a page that's living by itself in a provider-hosted app or wherever your imagination takes you. So let's take a look at this now and see how that happens.
So what you've showed so far is primarily the JavaScript aspects of that, correct?
Correct. Yeah. We showed the JavaScript and the C#. So the C# would drop me in there originally. So this is how they play nice together. We don't have any issues with you have to use JSON or CSOM. You can use them together. And this is a great example of that. That initial payload, there was no reason to reach back up. We're coming down at that point, so we used that CSOM, we grabbed it, we batched it up, we pulled my name down, we stuck it right in there. When I started typing, well, those events were triggered by JavaScript. So once I had two keystrokes, we reached back up and we looked up my user so I can select it. All right. So the JavaScript stuff is pretty interesting. I'm just going to scroll up here a little bit. You're going to see something that's pretty familiar if you've worked in JavaScript before with a framework jQuery, which I can pretty much assume most people have heard of jQuery. If you haven't, you've probably been living under a rock. jQuery is one of the most prolific frameworks for JavaScript. So we're calling the document.ready right there for jQuery. And we're building out some URLs that we're going to need. We're building out the SP host, the app web, and then we're deciding what the language was. We're grabbing all that stuff right out of the query string parameter with a helper method. Below that, we're starting to build out the actual path and how we can reference those. So I'm setting this layout, we're doing the SP host URL, and then we're passing in the layouts, underscore layouts 15. So what lives in there? Well, the JavaScript that we need. So we're using the get script command here to then start building out that. We're chaining these together. So if you notice, I've got some anonymous functions as we go down to chain these together. So we're loading our runtime, then we're loading our sp.js, and then we're loading the sp.ui that controls. You notice it's kind of tipping you off there with the render SP Chrome. That's the guy that you need to render that branding that we did when we F5'd it. So from there, we load out the rest of the JavaScript that we need. We grab the client context, as we've talked about in the slides and the other examples. I'm not going to make you guys dive right through that again. And then we start building out this people picker object. We're going to jump into that JS in a second. But I just want to illustrate, we're using a namespace called camcontrol.peoplepicker. We're passing in the context, and then we're getting handles to a bunch of HTML items using the jQuery selectors. So we're passing those handles in that we're going to use to populate data. We're setting our instance name and our language. And then we set just set some properties. We're setting, you know, maximum number of entries shown or 5, you know, all the just general entries that we might need. And then we're initializing it. So let's take a look at what that means. And this is the file very specifically I was pointing to that. I'm not going to go through this whole thing. It's pretty long. You guys can do that when you download these samples. But I'm starting here at this, what I consider the good stuff, the meat and potatoes, so to speak. I'm doing a check right here where we're checking to see if we've reached that minimal character set before we start searching. So once we have, if you remember, when I started typing, it said searching first, and then it brought my name down. So this is where we assign that result display, and we start doing that, the looking for what we're doing. Below, we build out a query here, right in JavaScript, where we got a var query, and we're doing a new sp.ui.applicationpages.clientpeoplepickerqueryparameters. I know that's long, sorry. We build out a bunch of stuff on that, what we need. We're passing in, you know, just all different properties. We're passing in the search text, which is the string that I started typing. And then we're actually executing that. We're using the sp.ui.applicationpages. I'm not going to read the rest of that. I'm just going to scroll over so you can see it because it's super long. So remember, we've done all this, and then we're getting the search results. So in Steve's slides, he was showing you how there's, you know, you can grab search results versus, you know, bringing back the loaded objects and things like that. Here's a great example of bringing back those search results. But we really haven't done anything yet. Because remember, I've got to execute that query. I've just built up what I want to do. So the important thing that happens here is the method that is highlighted, which is an example of that async programming that we talked about. We don't want to block our UI thread. You know, back in, and I know a lot of people are pretty familiar with this, but it was only a couple years ago where everyone was, especially in my opinion, in the .NET world, was blocking that UI thread. We're doing everything in a single-threaded model, and we were just saying, hey, user experience is kind of important, but we got to get our data. Let's just do that. You know, my passion's for UX, really. I love responsive design and truly effective user experiences. So using these async models will allow us to truly keep that a snappy experience. Now, when we call this async, we need to decide what we're going to do once we do come back. So we've got a couple things over here. We've got some delegates we're assigning, and we've got a query success and a query failure. We were successful. I'm not going to look at the failure because that's just plumbing code. Let's look at the success. What happens when we are successful? Okay. There we go. We've created a prototype here for the query success, and it equals this function, passing the query number and the search results. At that point, we have a var result, which is coming back from the SharePoint context, parsed objects, we're passing in to get the search result and the get value. We're building all that, we're grabbing all that data, we're assigning it, and then we're popping it into our HTML. If there's a result, and if the result is greater than 0, we then display it. So that's how that people picker works. You know, it's all just JavaScript, JSON. So we're able to accomplish quite a bit, which was difficult to do in the 2010 days when using that people picker. You know, I've been on several assignments myself where we spent, you know, a week or two just kind of messing around with it, trying to get it to do what the customer wants. And now, through examples such as this, we can kind of do some pretty creative things pretty quickly and without impacting the server.
And this was one of the, when we shipped 2013 in our new app model, this was one of the most oft-requested things. I want a people picker. And so we know that there's a ton of different versions and examples of out there on the internet of people pickers. For those of you that were in the developer keynote, the product team just released a preview of a people picker control. So we listened, we heard you, but this is not the concrete implementation of that one. This is a different sample.
So. The goal of a lot of these, the code that we're walking through is kind of, we want to spark your creativity. You know, we've got a whole new tool set here of how we can do things from the client side up, but that also means we have a whole new possibility, a whole new range of possibilities of things we can do. So we're hoping that you guys leave, you're excited about this, and you kind of get your creativity going. You can build the next generation of awesome SharePoint apps and apps that leverage SharePoint as a back end. I mean, this could be phone, it could be tablet, it could be whatever you'd like, really. So it's something that I think is important to note. So, while Steve was talking there, I switched over to another version of Visual Studio here, so I didn't want people to think I'm still working on People Picker. We said we had two demos in a row, so please don't gloss over yet. We have more code to go. So right now we're looking at HTML again. This is a default ASPX. It's very similar to before, so I wanted to call that out. We're calling the scripts.app.js, and we've got jQuery again. Again, I'm just going to show you, scroll through here. It's just HTML, nothing crazy. But I'm actually going to look at that code behind again here too. And we're going to look at the button create click event here. So when this happens, we reach back out. We grab that SharePoint context again. We're doing that from the current, as we showed before, I was building out an authentication in the console app. We're building out that authentication where I had a highly secure environment where I passed my password right in and all that. But this is using the current.getSharePoint context. So it's just a little different implementation. I wanted to make sure I called that out. We're getting a client context version of that with our using statement here. And then we're specifying this new URL. We're calling some code we're going to walk through in a second here, deployment manager.createSubsite. We're passing in a bunch of information that we're going to collect from the HTML page that I showed earlier, and that's going to render our result. So let's dive into to this code. I'm going to go through all this code, then I'm going to F5 it, show you what the results are, which I consider pretty impressive, and then we're going to go on from there. So let's look at this deployment manager. This is first we're going to look at the app.js, because again, this is a hybrid. It's a little less of a hybrid, but the important thing I wanted to call back out here is we are doing some things in, where's the app.js, there we go. So we're doing the same thing we did before, we're rendering that Chrome. We needed to make sure this was branded. So in a lot of examples, these provider-hosted apps will always, if you're using the C# side, they are going to always be that hybrid model where you're using some JSON too, because you want to be able to pull down that branding. So let's look at the CS file here. We called the method from our previous page, the create subsite, and we passed a ton of stuff into it. Again, I'm not going to read all these properties that we're passing in there. You'll see them when I actually run this, what I have to enter, and these are just them. There's one thing I did forget to show you guys, I believe. Let me scroll up. So this example is going to, we're going to build out a subsite. And in order to do that, we needed some custom input. So that custom input's in a config file, and I'm just going to open that up because I know at 5:57, everyone's going to absolutely love to look at some XML on a screen. The reason I'm bringing this up, I just want to call out, this is an implementation used for this. This XML was a decision made that we needed to reference some information in order to build these subsites out. This was just a choice made. This could be a JSON file. It could be a web service that you're calling out to. There's no reason it has to be this. I think this is a great implementation for storing this information. But I just want to really make sure people know there's no reason you have to use XML or you have to use this schema for XML. It's just a way we stored the data. Don't worry, I'll get that out of your face. I know no one likes to look at XML. So we're going to read that XML in. We're going to basically pull all the data out that we need so we can then use it for users to see on the screen to select. That's the whole point of that file, and we'll see that when I do run this. All right, let's get back down to the method that does the work. Okay. So right here, we're getting that SharePoint context from the current SharePoint context, and then we're creating a client context, and we're calling the deploy manager create subsite. So in the deploy manager create subsite, we're basically going through, we're building up this web creation information object where we're specifying the site template, the description, the title, the URL, the language. We're specifying English for this one. And then we're creating an instance of the client web from the client context web. We're passing that web in and we're loading it. So we're gonna executing that query, we're hydrating that at that point. So we've reached up to the server and hydrated it. Then we're gonna call if this is not a child site, we're going to call web.webs.add, and we're going to pass information in. Information was that object right here, the web creation information object that we've built up. Now, if this is a child site, we're calling subweb.webs.add information. We're going to execute that query, we're going to load it, we're going to execute the client context, and from there, we have to call a bunch of methods. I'm going to show you one of these because they all do a very similar thing. I don't think at this time everyone wants to look through each one of these because they are similar. So we're going to look at the deploy files. All right. So for deploy files, we're basically taking the files that we need when we build a site and we're pushing them out. So we're passing in the client context, the web, the file.attribute source, and all the information. We're calling the deploy file to web folder. We're going to go down and take a look at that. So we've got a folder called a JS folder. We're seeing if it exists. We're then taking the web.folders.add for that JS folder. We're loading the client context. We're passing in that object for the JS folder. We're executing that query, and then we're calling the upload file to web. So the upload file to web is right here. So again, we're doing a file creation information object. It's a new file called new file. We're specifying all the information we need, including the URL, whether we should overwrite it. This is all stuff we've done, similar stuff that we've done on the server side, but now we're on the client side doing it. We're then going to pass in the upload file we're calling load and execute. So that's going to upload that. So I'm going to go right back up to line 65, which is where I was. Did I go too far? Not yet.
So basically, after you provisioned the site, you added a file into a document library at that point. Or is it master page gallery?
These are this is what we need to make this page look the way we need it to look, and all the files needed to create that site. So bear with me, I'm gonna just get up here where I was.
Yeah, keep going.
Sorry for making everyone dizzy at this time on a Friday. All right, here's where we were. So we called deploy file. I'm not going to walk you through the rest of these. They're doing something very similar. So I figured that we can leave that little air of mystery there, what's actually going on there. I promise you it's very similar. You're going to get this code. I just don't want to have too much gray goo come out of people's ears. We're checking to see if it is a child site again. We're calling a deploy subsite, and then we're passing that information in. We're returning the new web.url. So let's take a look and see what this does. You know, we went through a lot of code here. It seems like a little abstract probably, but how powerful is this? I'm gonna F5 this. Demo gods are gonna be with me. Last one, it's looking good. And I'm gonna log back into my tenant. Now again, just to remind you, we're going right against my multi-tenant O365 environment. Logging in. We're looking at my usarugby.sharepoint URL. We switch now. We are now in our provider-hosted app. It's a local host right now. And remember I said we were going to build out some things we needed to build a subsite? Well, that's what these fields are. We maintain our branding, like I said we would. So we've got this nice blue bar across the top from that JavaScript that we called. Now I'm going to be very creative. As you can see, I've tried this a couple times, and I'm going to follow suit with my awesome creativity, and we're going to call this one 4. Four. And remember from that XML file telling you we're reading that data and I needed it for something? Well, here's where I needed it, this template section. And if you notice, these templates are not templates that come out of the box. These are custom templates. So that information is all specified right in that XML file. And again, that doesn't have to be an XML file. It could be JSON, it could be a web service, whatever you need it to be. I'm going to select the garage template here, and we're going to click create. So this is going to go out. It's going to batch up all that information that we're talking about. It's going, you know, it's reaching up. It's getting the template information out of the config file. It's taking those files and uploading them as needed. It's provisioning that subweb. So it's going to take a little bit of time to churn through and do that work for us. This is an example where this is an asynchronous call. I mean, this is a synchronous call at this point. It's reaching out, and it has to wait to do this work. So that's why we've got the spinning wheel here showing us what we're accomplishing, all from a provider host. And again, we are not on that server. This is not code running in SharePoint. It's code running with SharePoint. So that's always an important thing to illustrate. And here you go. Here's the subweb that we created. We specified the garage URL, which is difficult to do, actually. We've got the name, the very creative name of subsite 04 that I've decided to use. And we've got an awesome branding here. This looks nothing like what we had before.
And you didn't need a custom web template. You didn't need a WSP solution to deploy that. You didn't need to inject anything into SharePoint from a declarative perspective, right?
No, sir. We injected a little, and there's one piece that I kind of omitted, and it's a small piece for the custom action, injected some JavaScript. But the point is here, like Steve said, we didn't need all that stuff. We were able to do this right from a CSOM implementation. So this is a great example of how you can get actual work done for a company, either yours or one that you're working for, consulting for, that does not impact the performance of that server. It can run on another environment, and it, you know, obviously this does not look like an out-of-the-box branding. This is very different, obviously. So with that, we're going to switch back to a couple slides, And then we're going to jump over to some questions.
And we know the Ask the Experts is coming up, and people are itching to get over there, so we'll end this soon.
Okay. So all this code that I showed, and I'm going to correct myself. When I demo code, I always say I, because I'm demoing the code. This code was written by many people. A couple of them are in this room right here, right now. And it's for everyone to download. You just go out to officeams.coplex.com, and the actual code that I was demoing here comes down and much, much more. There's tons of samples in this download that can really help you catapult your development forward. So I highly recommend going out there, remembering that URL, and grabbing this code, because I showed you three examples. There's got to be 20 in there.
Yeah. So I mean, and there will be more. There's an effort going on. We know that there's a lack of really good complete samples, and so we've got a team of folks, both in the product team and also in Microsoft Services, working together to get this out there. If you're afraid to tear apart code, one, you wouldn't be in a 400-level session, so you're probably not here. And two, you can also wait for official MSDN documentation. We didn't want to wait. Sometimes our content publishing folks take a long time to get things done. We do have the site provisioning and branding examples. We have official documentation, so if you're the kind of person that wants lots of things to read while you're, you know, maybe taking a break, then there are solution packs on MSDN as well that talk about the first two scenarios, but as Travis said, there's about 18 more in this sample pack. There's a link to the solution pack from this CodePlex site as well, so tear it down, enjoy, let us know what you think. And then I think we've got some related sessions here. It's towards the end. This deck will be available on Yammer. I'm not going to sit here and read all these things to you. And here's our calls to action. So with that, we know that the Ask the Experts is there and that it's getting ready. It's starting now, I think.
Started a few minutes ago.
So if you would like to ask us questions, please just find us over there. I'll be over there in the developer section. So will Travis. Yep. Find us over there. We can talk all kinds of CSOM, JSOM. So, all right. Thanks.